from which grow stems and various, you know, nouns and verbs and adjectives and so on. So dharma, like every other Sanskrit word, is traced to a root, a verbal root, which is tur, meaning to sustain, to hold. And so dharma, if you look at the history of the word dharma, dharma has an early meaning in Sanskrit, which you find in older literature, where it means an essential characteristic of something. And the connection between this definition, essential characteristic, and the root of to hold or sustain is that an essential characteristic is precisely something that holds or sustains the identity of something. For example, water is liquid. So if it ain't liquid, it ain't water. You know, it may be ice, it may be steam, it may be this or that, but liquidity is an essential characteristic of water that sustains its identity as such. And so, like a typical poetic statement you'll find in ancient Sanskrit literature is that the kala, that the time dharma, the dharma of time overcame someone, because the one essential quality of time is that it ultimately takes everything apart. Everything dies in this world in time. And so to say that kala dharma, the dharma of time overcame a person, is to say that the person died. So you have that sort of core meaning of dharma, and then you have an extremely significant, what became really the most prominent application of this word in the sense of varnashram dharma. The idea is that human society was that is understood that people are born with duties. People are born with duties. So a man, a woman, a king, an artisan, a brahmana, a married person, a celibate student, a retired couple, a complete renouncer, that in all these different stages of human life and all these different vocations, people have duties. Again, we have a conception in America that people are born to enjoy, to buy things and enjoy them and all that. But back then they were a little more sober, I think in various senses of the term. And so the idea was that we are born to fulfill duties, and by the fulfillment of sacred duties, one ennobles oneself, one ultimately exalts oneself, and ultimately achieves yoga, which literally means connection or link, and one reconnects to the Supreme Being. So let's say someone is a king. What sustains that person's identity as a king, as a legitimate king, is their honest performance of certain sacred duties, such as treating all the people equally, providing justice, protecting the people from danger, making sure that there's general prosperity in the land, and so on and so forth. So in the act of performing this, what would be called Raja Dharma, what would be called Raja Dharma, or Royal Dharma, or King's Dharma, one becomes a real king. It sustains their identity. So going back to this little Sanskrit proverb I started with, that human beings and animals are identical. They're the same in terms of satisfying their basic animal needs. However, dharma, in dharma, it's in a human being's capacity to recognize and accept and perform sacred duties that the human beings actually rise to a special plane. So dharmehi teshang adhiko visheso. Therefore, the simple logic here is dharmena hina pashubhi samana, that human beings that do not perform dharma are simply the same as animals. They're just engaged in bestiality, even if it's very sophisticated bestiality, the kind you see advertised in airline magazines, you know, like eat at this restaurant and all, you know, all that stuff. So this initial impulse that there's something more to life out there or in here, but there's something more to life that my consciousness, I'm sort of underachieving in terms of my cognitive powers, and I could be much more conscious, I could realize many more things, I could connect with all kinds of exalted beings and things, and I can understand it in a much more profound way. And so you could say that's the impulse to philosophy, it's the impulse to spirituality. And so there's how should I put it? There is a, I don't want to say a problem, but there is an issue that, that must be dealt with, and every spiritual tradition, religious tradition, has tried their own way to deal with it. And that is the fact that in many cases among philosophers, especially older philosophers like Plato, who weren't, anyway, won't say, talk about modern philosophers, because like my mother used to say, if you can't say something nice about somebody, don't say anything. So, but if you look at some of these ancient great philosophers, and certainly serious spiritual traditions, there is the great dream or vision, goal, aspiration of transcending, of ascending, and yet we are very much in the material world. So questions arise, like, what is the status of this world? What is ultimately the status of this world? What is the best possible relationship for me to have with the world so that my spiritual practice flourishes? And I want to present what I believe to be two extreme answers to this question. And I think two answers which are very common in the history of ideas, but were so extreme that ultimately they are not practical, and that there is a happy middle point. The middle, as Buddha said, you know, the middle way. And of course, in a sense, we're speaking about metaphysics, the Greek meta, you know, after, beyond, what is beyond the physical, what is above the physical. But in order to understand the metaphysical, one also has to understand the physical and the relationship between the two. So I want to talk about how to practice Krishna consciousness, but I'm sort of revealing my own sorry plight that I was born with this kind of brain. That I really like to have a roadmap, know where I'm going, and why should I be doing this, and what's the big picture, and so on. So I'm just going
to... I could have sent you one, just to, like, I could have emailed me, I could have downloaded one and sent it to you.
So the two extremes. There is a whole class of traditions which you could say include certain extreme forms, or at least in this sense extreme, of Hinduism, Buddhism, even Christianity, Judaism. So it's again, the way of categorizing religions like Jew, Christian, Muslim, Hindu, if you look at ancient Sanskrit literature, they didn't do that so much. They didn't have that. It was more... The typology was more like based on your philosophy, your approach. Did you believe you could achieve success by austerity, by self-abnegation, by charity, by philosophy, by devotion? And so this cuts across all the sectarian religious boundaries. And so, because in every major religion, by major I just mean it's been around long enough to develop a full range of approaches. I mean, there's enough people in it, and it's been around long enough so that all the human propensities have been manifested. You'll find all these things. You'll find the mystics. You'll find, you know, the charitable, pious people. You'll find the ascetics. You'll find the philosophers, and so on. And so, so this extreme position I'm talking about refers to an approach which you find in every religion, not necessarily a majority approach. In some of these traditions, it became a central or majority approach. In others, it was just something on the side, but you find it everywhere. And that is an extreme rejection of the world. Actually, both these extremes reject the world, but the two rejections are, you could say, philosophical and moral. So first of all, I'll get to the philosophical rejection of the world. And you find this, for example, very clearly in the philosophy of Shankara, Adi Shankara, who was a great... you could say, impersonalist philosopher in India, who lived about approximately 1,200 years ago, and he wrote an extremely famous, in India, commentary on Vedanta. And his followers, as often the case, we study the history of religions, the followers of a great teacher are more extreme than their teacher. They kind of, as we see in many religions. And so the Shankara movement, based on certain many things he said and based on the way his first generation disciples interpreted and so on, became a movement which very famously said that the material world in a radical sense is illusion. That ultimately there is a single truth, Brahman, and everything is one, Everything is one in an unqualified sense. It's not that, like, we're one, of course. You're you and I'm me, and we're in different bodies, but we're one. No, it's not that. We're not talking about a powerful unity. We're talking about the fact that when you see different colors, so that there can be art and beauty, like the beautiful picture there and here, these beautiful pictures, that beautiful visual, like different shapes and different colors and or different pitches and sounds, so you get melody and harmony, different individual people, the fact there can be relationships, people can fall in love or form very deep friendships because we're individuals and yet we're connected. All this is illusion. And when you become enlightened, there are no colors, there's no melody or harmony, there's no visual beauty, there are no relationships, there's just one entity, if you could call it that, which is Brahman. It's just all one. This is like radical monism. And of course, because this world is full of variety, and because, as the Buddhists never tired of pointing out back in the days of Buddhist philosophy, Nagarjuna and so on, every object in this world is really in a state of flux. It's engaged in a process. So you can point to a chair or a body or the moon and call it such, but actually it's just it's a process. It's changing at every moment. By the way, there's sort of a Buddhist philosopher in Europe. I mean, he wasn't a Buddhist, but Heraclitus, who's actually at the same time as Buddha, a pre-Socratic philosopher, who said that you can't step in the same river twice. He's famous for having said that. And so this notion that everything in the world is temporary, everything's in flux, that what appears to be an object is really just a continuous stream of states of being, and so on. This was an idea which was really popular in the world, in Europe and India, about 2,500 years ago. But for all these reasons, because the world has variety, and because and objects in this world are not eternal, and so on and so forth, there is a radical rejection of the world. If you think of the shunyata, emptiness, the shunyata doctrine of Buddhism, and what they meant was, it wasn't like complete nihilism, like nothing exists. It was just that every particular object is empty of ultimate identity or meaning, because there is no object, it's just constantly changing. So, but the result of whether it's the Buddha Shunyata doctrine, and again, the most prominent philosopher is Nagarjuna, or whether it's Shankara's sort of Vedic version of Buddhism, you could say, in his what's called Mayavad philosophy, or his Vedanta interpretation, you have a radical rejection of the world. The world is simply an illusion. Period. Next. And even Ishwar, even God, the idea that there is a God, the way I used to describe it when I taught this is that when illusion hits your eye like a big pizza pie, that's Ishwar, that's the Lord. So, and that's kind of it. That's kind of what Shankara taught. So now, that is what I would call a philosophical rejection of the world. And on the other side, say in the certain forms of Judeo-Christianity, because obviously there's a tremendous variety of approaches, but in certain forms, certain philosophical forms of Judeo-Christian teaching, and even I think you'd throw in certain philosophical forms of Islam, there's the idea that, not so much arguing philosophically to a rejection of the world, but almost arguing on moral grounds, in the sense that God is the holiest, you know, the holiest. God is pure, supreme holiness, and the world is sort of pure, supreme profanity. And therefore, to juxtapose these two things is the greatest offense. And therefore, you have this sort of ferocious iconoclasm. The idea that, for example, when during the Protestant Reformation, if you look at the 15th century and certain movements like what was called the iconoclastic fury, which took place in the lowlands in Netherlands and I suppose in certain parts of Belgium, because Belgium was never free from the stuff that goes on in the Netherlands. Anyway, so these gangs of people, violent gangs of Protestant reformers, would go into Catholic churches and smash all of the stained glass windows and just break all of the images, whether it was Virgin Mary or Jesus or whoever it was, just break the... I mean, they weren't invited to do that. They didn't have, like, a I mean, that wasn't legal. They were just violent gangs, and they would just smash everything they could find. And of course, you find this in the Wahhabi form of Islam. So, again, a violent rejection of the world. I mean, you could talk about Luther's rejection of the Renaissance, and the idea that sola scriptura. We don't want philosophy. We don't even Thomas Aquinas was like this, like out of control radical for them, because we don't want philosophy. We don't want science. Sola scriptura. That was one of the mottos of Luther, only scripture. And so this rejection of the world. Whereas in the Renaissance, people started to say, actually, God gave us two books. One book is the Bible. The other book is the book of nature. And anyway, that's a whole story we don't have time to go into now. The repudiation of the Renaissance, the repudiation of science and philosophy in the name of sort of like a Palestinian purist revival. So, but again, sort of when I say moral, I mean just like what you think is good and bad. I mean, just roughly. That's how I'm using the word. So, in the Judeo-Christian side and Islamic side, you find a moral rejection of the world, a radical rejection of the world. Of course, this is obviously not everybody. It's not all Buddhists. It's not all people on the Vedanta side. It's not all Christians. It's not all Jews. But still, you find these elements within all these traditions. And so Krishna consciousness, now that I roll out my product. Get out your checkbooks and credit cards. Okay, so Krishna consciousness, and of course many other traditions and many people within all the religions I just named, takes a more moderate view of saying that the world... You cannot philosophize away the world. The world doesn't philosophize away. It's really here. There really is a world, and it's not evil. We may perform, acts which are sort of horrendous, like shooting a 14-year-old girl because she wants an education. I mean, certainly human beings do incredibly stupid, evil things, but the world itself, the actual creation, is not evil. Now, I would say almost like that's so intuitively and just obviously correct that most people tend to come to that position. Very few people really philosophize away the world. They may be members of some group that does that, but they don't really do it in their real life. And even saying the world, the body's evil, the world's evil, I mean, that's not what narcissistic, hedonistic America does by any means. So... But there's a danger, because when you, so to speak, take back the world, when you say, no, the world cannot be philosophically dissolved and rejected, and the world is not evil, it can't be rejected on moral grounds, then some people go to the other extreme. And the other extreme would be to say, well, since the world is not evil, and so since the world really exists, we can just do whatever we want. And there's no form of hedonism or selfish gratification which is in any way morally inferior to the most altruistic, self-sacrificing behavior. And so sometimes people say, well, for example, I can take this substance because God created it. But they never really explain why you can't take poisons that God created, because there are many fully organic, naturally occurring poisons in the world. And so if it was really the case that if it grows, you can take it, that it doesn't really work. And so the idea that you can do anything because the world is not evil neglects the fact that you can misuse the world. For example, a surgeon's knife, you could say, is a beneficent instrument. It does good in the world. But a surgeon's knife, well, and we won't get into the whole allopathic thing, but there are people who are helped by invasive surgery at times. So, but that same surgeon's knife in the hands of, let's say, a bad person can become an instrument of evil. So is the knife good or bad? It's neither. Yes, it's just an instrument. And in a sense, you could even, I think you could even say it's ultimately good because it's part of God's creation. It's just like Aristotle has this, anyway, you better stay on the message here. So Krishna consciousness, based on this understanding, now we'll get down to the practical thing and try to give you your money's worth. Krishna consciousness accepts that the world is real. First of all, the world is real, even though objects in this world are temporary. I think what the Shunyata, the emptiness doctrine, and Shankara's version of it in his Vedanta impersonalism, what they neglect about the world is that even though, let's say, this chair, I mean, Nagarjuna would just like immediately object, wait a second, you can't call that a chair, because what you call a chair is just, you know, it's a bunch of material energy in motion. However, the fact is that it is serving as a chair, and it's doing that well. And so even though things are in flux, the flux is such that we can still name and utilize objects in this world to our great advantage. And you can't simply say that's nothing. That's not nothing, that's something. Now, if we take this world as ultimately real, if this world becomes so real to us that we either deny or just couldn't care less if there's, let's say, a higher world, then we're kind of getting pulled into the trap. And that's really the value of doctrines like Shunyata, emptiness, or Shankara's saying it's all illusion, is that it's healthy in the sense that it keeps us from becoming too attached and too absorbed in temporary things. However, we shouldn't go to the other extreme and deny the obvious fact that, first of all, the substance, we will give Aristotle at least a moment, a little cameo role. Aristotle used this word, the substance. So if you think of the word substance, it literally means to stand beneath something, substance. And so the idea is that this chair, which is, in motion here, but the energy is real, the energy is eternal. And so there is actually something, even though it's changing, even though the energy is sort of endlessly plastic and changing its shape, it's a shapeshifter, but still, it's real energy. It really exists. And it's not going away. And according to the Bhagavad Gita, it has no beginning, no ending. It's eternal energy. And it is a mark of God's benevolence that this energy in motion does stay long enough so you can sit down somewhere when your feet are tired. I mean, what if every chair in the world, by the time you got down to it, it moved and... You literally couldn't sit down.
Might be fun.
What's that?
Might be fun.
Yeah. Might be something the CIA would be interested in, you know, for rendition techniques. But so actually, objects in this world, I mean, they, like, for example, we have bodies. And these bodies are stable enough so that you can live a life. You can drink a cup of water. The water doesn't fly out of the cup. The cup doesn't dissolve in your hands. So simply to say that there are no objects is really sort of taking your eye off the ball. And you have to be a little more practical than that. And that's why actually, historically, when Nagarjuna and others came up with this very heavy emptiness doctrine, the sort of mainstream Buddhist world said, oh, that's nice, but because it wasn't playing very well on Main Street, and so they got into other things. So the idea is that in Vedanta, because this material world and all worlds come from an absolute truth, and this gets into the God thing, and there's a lot to discuss about that, the G word. Anyway, if anyone's interested, like in that, we can talk about it, but. We have, in some ways, a very glorious and noble, in some ways very nasty set of historical facts in terms of Western religion. And one point I make, then I'll go into practical Krishna consciousness, is we should not be trapped in Well, what I call...
Musical chairs?
Oh, hey, how are you?
Good.
Okay. No Rotten Tomatoes yet? So we...
I told you they were a very tame group.
Tame group, right.
And I was vaccinated, I also said. And you didn't bite.
What I call societal post-traumatic stress disorder. If you study PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, some of the main symptoms are hypervigilance. Hypervigilance, the typical cartoon example is a car backfires and a combat vet dives for cover. And so that's an example of hypervigilance, where because the nervous system is so shocked and is just so desperately anxious not to be shocked like that again, if anything remotely could lead to something, then you withdraw. And of course, that's the other symptom, withdrawal. Hypervigilance followed by withdrawal. Some people withdraw from relationships because they were so hurt in relationships, or all kinds of things. And so if you study the religious history of our Western civilization, I think, without question, it is... And there are many high moments, like Handel's music. But anyway, there are many really great moments. There were many... I want to be fair. In Western religions, there were many extremely admirable people. People who were profoundly devoted, wise, good, generous, and there was a lot of real God consciousness. So that should be said. Apart from that, not nullifying that, but apart from that, there is an unbelievably traumatic history. Just about as traumatic as it can get. I mean, there were times when some of the most clever minds in Europe literally had full-time jobs just thinking of what is the absolutely most gruesome, horrific, painful way you can torture somebody. And, decades after Newton, professors at some of the best universities in Europe were still writing articles on how to identify the true witch, so you don't murder someone who's not really a witch. Anyway, I mean, I don't just say crusades, Inquisitions, all these. We all know the history. So again, there were a lot of really great people, and there was a lot of unbelievable atrocities. And if you study the whole history of Western civilization, as Europe starts to come out of sort of the Monty Python Middle Ages, and you get the early Renaissance, and then the later Renaissance, and then you get the Age of Reason in the 1600s, and then you get the Enlightenment in the 1700s, and it just keeps going. And so more and more people in the West, especially sort of thinking, educated people, are trying to free themselves from this nightmare of what has come before. And so again, hypervigilance. So now, in America, you have a situation where you have, pardon the crude expression, but sort of like a New Age culture. And I know it's a crude term, but it'll save time. So you have this New Age culture, and then you have, let's say, more traditional religions. And so on the side of people who are not satisfied just with what came before, they want to see more things, they want to think more, and so on, there's a tendency to reject, sort of become the antithesis, reject some of the traditional language of religion. So that, for example, this is sort of a dialectical, antithesis, so that in response to fanaticism, like this is the only way, you get the equally extreme and frankly equally non-rational position that there is no objective way. So it becomes practically an attack on objectivity itself. That if someone claims that this is the highest truth, it's not only impolite, it's wrong. And you get this move where in order to make sure that no one ever feels they're wrong about anything, philosophy is reduced down to a subset of psychology. In other words, to say that something is philosophically true, all you're really saying is that it makes someone feel good. So if someone says, this is my truth, you're really just giving us more of a psychological report than a philosophical report. And So this whole attack on objectivity, the whole attack on any type of hierarchy. So my suggestion is that rather than fall into this trap, because just becoming the mirror opposite of something you don't like is a trap. And it is in relation, you know, I mean, anyway, you're old enough and intelligent enough to know what I'm talking about. And that there is, like, if you think of the dialectical thing, there's a synthesis where you move forward. You're not merely opposing and reacting to something that really bothered you, but you're actually positively moving forward. And so I think the way forward, as I call it, is principled inclusivism. In other words, to be inclusive, but at the same time to still maintain reasonable principles. Otherwise, you're forced, like, well, all religions are the same. Okay, well, if you blow up a school bus to make a political statement, you think God wants you to do that, then I guess that religion is as good as any other. And we don't really want to say that. So getting back to the point of practice, trying to put all these things together, bhakti yoga, the idea of yoga is connection. And because the world is not evil, and because we are, in a sense, made in the image of God, it's just... it has to be understood, you know, with some subtlety. But because there's a sense in which we are creations of God and the world is good, if properly understood, to really be spiritual, to put it that way, to really have a spiritual life, to have a spiritual consciousness, never to go back down, stay high forever, you know, that whole thing, we have to spiritualize all of our body. And all of our mind. In other words, even though, let's say, we are pure souls and we're in bodies, but every aspect of our existence, physical, mental, emotional, has to be spiritualized. Because, as Krishna says in the Gita, indriyanam hicharatam janmano vidyate, that the senses, for example, the eyes, ears, sort of roaming about looking for pleasurable objects. And if the mind becomes trapped in even one of the senses due to attachment, that will literally, Krishna says, tadasya harati pragyam, that will take away your higher consciousness. I mean, you can all experience this. Let's say you're having, like, you know, a really lucid moment. You're in really a good state of consciousness. You're detached. You're the witness of the world. And then you really become angry about something, or, you know, you're really lusty after something, or you're hungry and you can't stand it. Obviously, it blows up your higher consciousness. And so, therefore, if any aspect of our existence, frankly, whether it's physical, including sexual, whether it's emotional, whether it's philosophical, any aspect of our existence that we don't spiritualize will become our nemesis. It will pull us back into sort of fruitless, mundane consciousness. And so the practice, and I like that thing you quote, I think, Brother Lawrence, about practicing God's presence. Was that it? I thought that was really good. Practicing God's presence. So let's take eating, because eating is certainly a big part of our physical existence. And so there's the idea, which you find throughout world cultures, that you don't just eat. Like an animal, let's say, and you know, we're not against animals. Animals are also spiritual beings, and they also will eventually go to God, so this is not animal bashing. But in that stage of consciousness, an animal just goes with food and just guzzles it down. In spiritual, or even you could say more refined human consciousness, you don't just do that. You don't just go and eat. The food has to be offered. You have to make an offering. You find this, I think, in a very brilliant way in Homer, the Iliad and the Odyssey. For example, in the Iliad, just after one day's battle, in Troy, Hector, the great Trojan prince, comes back to the city after the day's battle, and he's exhausted. He's covered with dirt and blood. He's been fighting to save his city. He's been fighting for like 8 hours or something. And his mother looks at him in that condition and says to a court attendant, "Go offer a drink and bring it to him." In other words, you can't just drink. Even in that condition, it has to be offered before you drink it. And if you read the Odyssey, no respectable man or woman ever eats anything unless it's been offered to the gods. So the basic idea here was that everything is a gift, that we don't own the planet. We, even our bodies are a gift. We've been given this body. I mean, someone else makes the rain fall, makes the food grow. And before we eat, we have to acknowledge it. It's like, let's say you invite someone to your house for dinner, and they just come through the door. Don't say a word to you. Don't say like, well, thanks for inviting me. Just like go right to the table and just, you know, start pigging out. I mean, what would you think? Not a word. Like, well, thanks for inviting me. Thanks for all this great food or nothing. Well, that's how it looks to what's up there.
That's what we do in our houses. I mean, you come home from work, you're hungry, you just open the fridge, you put something on the counter, and you can start eating. You
know? Exactly.
I mean, it's such a habit of unconscious eating.
Of course. And I mean we, you know, it's everyone does that, but and so it's because it's so ingrained in us. It's so deeply ingrained in us that this is my body, this is my planet, this is my house, this is my food. And with all this my, we're really cutting off most of reality. Because most of reality is actually above us. And we're cutting it all off. And so when we create this horrible little claustrophobic world by seeing ourselves as the greatest, remember Cassius Clay? Remember that? Yeah. I'm the greatest. The price we pay for self-centeredness is that we are. It's like locking yourself in the trunk of your own car.
And driving from the trunk.
You're just putting yourself in this tiny little compartment because I am tiny. I'm, you know, infinitesimal compared to everything else. And so, whereas if I can become humble, something I'm working on, and in some future life, I envision becoming humble. But
I think you're already humble.
Well, thank you. So in our practice, to say the food is offered, we acknowledge. In our case, we accept Krishna. And it doesn't mean we reject Allah or Yahweh or anything like that, because to us it's sort of a no-brainer, there's one God. And some people would say, well, that's too many, that's one too many. But but that is, and again, it's God understood not in a Middle Eastern sense. And I say that because if you look at the religions of the world that really have had great historical influence, they only came from two places. It came from the Middle East and India. Because from India, you get Hinduism, Buddhism, and some things that were big but became shrunk a lot, like Jainism. And of course, then you get three Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity, and Islam. And they really come to just these two places. And so the notion we're presenting of the absolute truth or Brahman or God is different. It's a God that does not need a 12-step program for anger management or jealousy management or anything like that. He's not a serial torturer. So it's a very different conception, and it's a conception in which the word that Krishna uses in the Gita, the Sanskrit word is angsha, which literally means like an integral part. He says that every living being is actually an integral part of my existence. Another interesting thing about this conception of God is that it's male and female, in the sense that there's all these beautiful verses that in the absolute truth, which is the source of everything, there is a male and a female aspect. So it turns out that like the absolute truth as conceived here is the supreme couple. It's actually the an infinitely beautiful goddess, an infinitely beautiful God. So that, for example, romantic love in this world, the reason that we experience, you could say, a desire or need for romantic love, is because it exists originally in God as a source of everything. And so, we talked about food. Let's get, you know, the good things like food and sex. So then if you look at romantic love, Krishna has, there's an interesting statement in the Gita where Krishna says, dharma virudha kaunteya kamosmi bharatarshava, that I am even, like you say, like sexuality or that desire, when it does not oppose Dharma. Dharma viruddha. It doesn't oppose, it doesn't subvert or sabotage virtue and justice. And so what does that mean? That it doesn't oppose justice, it doesn't oppose virtue. In the postmodern world, they've made this, there's a word to objectify someone, which is a negative. It doesn't mean to see someone objectively. It means that every one of us, every living being, is actually a subject. You are the unique, irreducible center of your own personal life. And therefore, even though when I look at you, let's say I see your body, and so your body is an object of my sight. And let's say, for example, if someone wants to enjoy someone else's body by touching it or whatever, then again, it becomes an object of another sense. Or if you want someone you're attached to say flattering things to you, then again, you... So in that sense, there's a tendency to see other people as objects of our consciousness, which is really, literally degrading them. Because no one ultimately is an object of my consciousness. Everyone is the subject of their own life and the subject of their own consciousness. And so the stronger the material desire is in us, the more it sort of blocks out every other consideration, including moral. I mean, imagine, for example, if you were really hungry. I mean, like, ridiculously hungry. And someone said, "Hi, can I tell you what I did yesterday? You know, I was trying to get my bike fixed, but the funniest thing happened. I went to the bike shop and..." I mean, you're starving. So, and of course, as we know, great cases, Les Miserables by Victor Hugo, Jean Valjean. Anyway, but if you get hungry enough, you're going to just take some food. You may not be a thief by nature, but if you're hungry enough, or someone you love is hungry enough. And so in the same way, the more, or the stronger we have any physical desire, whether it's sex desire, hunger, fatigue, anything, the more we simply are unable to be broad-minded, think about other things, the less we are able to think about your needs. Like if my needs are just overwhelming me, either I'm in pain or I'm hungry, whatever, if my needs are overwhelming me, I haven't got the luxury of just, well, forget me, let's talk about what you need. I haven't got that luxury. And that's why the more we cultivate, let's say, sex desire, like it's funny because most civilized societies understood, okay, it's real, we have to deal with it, no problem, it's not evil, but just deal with it and go on with life. But our culture tries to inflame it to an absolute fever pitch. It's like you can't sell anything in this country, whether it's, I don't know, like... You know, like rubber tubes for plumbing or anything, unless somehow it has a libidinal dimension to it. And so, and being proud of your body, it's like, I'm proud of my body. It's okay, don't hate your body. I mean, you know, appreciate your body, be grateful for your body, take care of your body, you know, treasure it as a very valuable gift you've got from God. But you're not the body. You're an eternal soul, because if I say I am the body, I'm condemning myself. If you're against capital punishment, don't say I'm the body. Because this body's going to die. And if you claim I am the body, you are awarding yourself capital punishment. Whereas if you... Therefore, I could never figure this out. Like, why would someone, like, dedicate their life to proving, you know, we're the body? Like certain so-called, you know, wannabe philosophers that deal with neurology and all that. It's like, why are you trying to... I mean, if there's an eternal you in there, even if you're not sure, let's say you're agnostic, you just don't know. But if there is an eternal self or soul or whatever word doesn't stir up bad memories of your childhood, you know, if there's an eternal you in there, then you get to live forever. I mean... Wouldn't you want to try for that? I mean, what if someone, say, God forbid, is drowning in the ocean, and a lifeboat comes and throws a, what do they call a buoy, or a...
A life rafter.
Yeah, yeah.
Life
preserver, and then you say, no, that probably won't work. You just, I think I'll just drown, because that probably won't work. It's like, obviously you grab it and hope it's real. So here we are drowning in this ocean of birth and death. And we have all this wisdom coming to us, people claiming from all around the world, from all different traditions, claiming that there's an eternal self or soul. Nah, not worth the trouble. I don't think that's true. I don't believe that. It's like it's your only chance. It's that was Pascal's point, Pascal's wager. It's like, where's your sense of adventure? Where's your sense of the value of your own life? Don't you value yourself enough to try anything to preserve your unique, beautiful existence? I mean, are you going to give up on your own, on your existence that easily? So, because the way I put it, there's a certain bravado, like, well, I'm not afraid of death, I don't care if I die. But actually, it's just a logical fact that if you place a positive value on something, then there must be a negative value in losing it. If you can lose something, and it means nothing to you, it means it had no real positive value for you. Or you've got so many other things, like, okay, I gave away a pair of shoes, but I've got 93 pairs of shoes. Or, I didn't need that, I didn't want it. How can you really value something and not care if you lose something you truly value? So this bravado, I'm not afraid of death, I don't care if I die, just means you place no value on your life. Or you're just showing off. So the idea is that in our practice, we spiritualize the body. It's not artificial, not artificially repressing the body, because that doesn't work anyway. Actually, Krishna says in the Gita that visaya vinivartante niraharasya dehinam. He gives the example of someone who's fasting. Niraharasya. Someone, say, is fasting. And this is a typical monastic strategy in many different religions, that if someone's a monk or taking a vow of celibacy and they're getting a little too romantic or their body's getting a little too whatever, then stop eating. Because when you stop eating, just fast. Do a fast, and then it's like, you know, you just can't do it because you're fasting. And so, but then Krishna says, so if you do this, if you fast, then yes, the objects of the senses will sort of pull back because you're weakening your body. However, rasavarjan, but the taste for it does not go away. So, you know, let's say I can fast as a strategy to control my sex desire, but then one really good meal and I'm back in action. So then Krishna says, param drishtva, but if I experience something which is greater, then the taste goes away. And I give this example so many times, and eventually, you know, every 20 years I come up with some new material. But when we were all young, we had toys, you know, games, toys, and we were attached to them, and don't touch, that's my toys. But then at a certain point, we just outgrew it. It's not that we went through some kind of wrenching, traumatic process of renouncing our toys. We
get bigger toys.
Yeah, exactly. We outgrew those toys. That's like American capitalism, Toys R Us. So we just outgrew it and went on to some, you know, bigger and sometimes lower things. So the idea is that we have to outgrow our material desires. We can outgrow this sense of ourselves as a physical body. It's not something artificial. It's not that you just sort of make yourself and other people feel guilty. It's you just outgrow it. So the emphasis is not on giving up. It's on growing spiritually. The emphasis is on spiritually growing. And so what we actually do is, like I said, the food, you eat spiritual food, you offer it with real devotion. Music. I mean, you know, many of us are music lovers. I've been playing music most of my life. And Baroque.
Baroque?
Yeah, I really love Baroque music. But now I compose devotional songs. But so you can do music. I mean, look at the Psalms, the great Psalms of David, where he talks so much about singing and dancing for God. And of course, you know, David was obviously a kirtan guy. So, I mean, music, dancing, friendship, love, food, our intellectuality, our just everything, all of our creative impulses, our physical impulses, our social impulses, our everything, somehow or other, you can spiritualize. You can, and of course, the word for that, where you take, say, your ordinary worldly life and you spiritualize it all, is karma yoga. Because the word yoga means a disciplined practice or a spiritual practice. And karma, karma has many meanings. The word karma in Sanskrit comes from a root, no surprise there, which is Crete. And by the way, it's cognate with, it's related to, historically, our English words like create. Create and increase and so on, crecer. So, karma literally, like the root meaning of the word karma is action. Because it comes from a Sanskrit root which means to do, or to act. To act. And so it literally means action, and it comes to mean, in an important, special sense of the word, a cosmic set of laws by which actions produce reactions. And that's karma, you know, one's karma. So that is one sense of the word, and it's an important sense, but it's only one sense of the word. It generally means action. And it can also mean duty. It also takes on another idiomatic sense that, you know, what you should do, which literally would be Kartavya in Sanskrit, but karma, in other words, your duty, what your appropriate duty is. Just like, let's say, if you're a parent, it's completely appropriate for you to take care of your child in every sense. And so that becomes your karma, the sense of your duty. So it's in that sense we get karma yoga. That's the sense of karma yoga. That you take your duties, you take your actions in life, and you devote them to God. Whoops. It's like Krishna says in the Gita that jet karoti, whatever you do, jet karoshi, jetashnasi, whatever you eat, jet juhoshi, whatever you offer in sacrifice, the dasiyat, whatever you give in charity, jet tapasyasi kontaya, whatever austerities you perform, tat kurusam and arpana, make that an offering to me. So, now, does that mean that God is, you know, has fallen on hard times and this is kind of like a racket? Religion was created by God to try to kind of, or maybe, you know, he likes people praising him, it makes him feel good. Now, the idea is that, I mean, think about it. I mean, you probably had similar experience when I was a little kid. I would get presents from my parents on their birthday, but, you know, the other parent would take me and we'd buy something for the parent whose birthday it was. And, or you do things in school, you know, you do these little drawings when you're a little kid in school, and then you give them to your parents, and your parents are like besides themselves with happiness. They like it so much. Although, I mean, what's the real value? I mean, it's obviously it's not the object itself. It's just the fact that a child whom they love very much is learning to reciprocate. And actually, if parents did not teach their children to reciprocate love, they would just produce little monsters. Mm-hmm. So, teaching a child to honor love and to reciprocate it appropriately is a very important part of teaching a child of good character and virtue. And so if you think of God as a supreme parent, which some people will find struggle with, but like Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, Pitaham Asya Jagato, I'm the father of this universe, Mata, and the mother, by the way. Not just the father, but the mother. And Pitaham Asya Jagato Mata, Dhata, the creator, Pitamaha, the grandfather, and so on. Bless you. So that's the basic practice, things we do. We get up early. As I say in Spanish, they got the quien madruga, Dios ayuda. One who gets up early, God helps. God helps those who get up early.
Could you say that again?
Oh, quien, whoever. Quien madruga. Madrugada means like dawn, like the early part of the day. Brahma Muhurta in Sanskrit. So, quien madruga, whoever gets up early, Dios ayuda. God helps them. So, King Madruga in Portuguese. No one should from Brazil. Same thing in Portuguese. Anyway, so.
Is that like the early bird gets the worm?
Yeah, right. The early bird gets the tofu, so. And of course, Ben Franklin, who was a good old Benjamin Franklin, you know, early to rise and all that. And there is something natural about that, because if you live in the country, especially without electricity, I had the pleasure of spending months and months without electricity years ago. I was doing work in Latin America, did years of work in Latin America, and so I was living on a farm in Brazil that had no electricity. And as a city boy, I realized that as I stayed out there day after day, week after week, that my whole, I don't know what you want to say, my whole body or mind began to lock into the movements of the sun and the moon. It wasn't a practice. I just realized that I just always knew where the sun was and where the moon was, and you just start getting up early. It's just, when you get your body, when you can work your way back to a pre-electricity, pre-industrial revolution sort of mind, life, you see that you just start doing it. Because when the sun goes down, you go home. Because you're not going to stay out in the country. There's people out there, different kinds of creatures and so on. And so when the sun goes down, you're out in the country, you go home. Or you set up your camp. And if the day's work sort of stops then, then after another hour or two, you just sort of lie down and go to bed, go to sleep. And then you get up early. And it's just, your body just sort of gets into it. And so, So rising early, that's another important thing. We rise early and have a spiritual practice. Once the sun comes up, the sun, of course, is just like the great energizer. And once the sun comes up, everybody's out there and at it, up and at it. And,
unless you live here in the summer. Unless you live here in the summer, then you're somewhere else. It's hot,
But in general, when the sun comes up, it's just, the day starts and everybody starts calling you and you got to do this and you got to do that. And so the idea is that rising before sunrise, which is called the spiritual time in Sanskrit, Brahma Muhurta, Kid Madhruva, is because when you rise early, the world is not at work yet. And so you just have all this precious serenity. And I think one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen in my life is just to watch all the different stages of a sunrise. All the different colors, it's just, celestial beauty. And so you get up early, you have your spiritual practice, the whole world, there's just serenity in the world. You do your spiritual practice, you offer some food to God, you eat the food, and then whatever you're going to do that day, by that time, you're fixed in consciousness. What we do, our particular meditation, is Harinama, the names of God, reciting the names of God. If you study world religions, you'll find every world religion, there is emphasis on the name of God, actually. The idea being that God is present in his or their name. So, to give an example, if you read the Old Testament and all the passages surrounding the construction of the first temple in Jerusalem, which David, it was David's project, but because of some glitches, he couldn't actually build the temple, so his son Solomon did. So if you read the biblical passage about David conceiving of the project, like, let's build a temple, and then the actual construction of it, and the grand opening, and then remembering the glory of the temple, in all these passages, we find again and again and again, it is a temple to the name of God. And that as God lives in heaven, his name will live in the temple, or lives in the temple. So the Temple of Jerusalem is actually a temple to the name of God. And of course, there are certain forms of Buddhism, Nam-myoho-renge-kyo, and the Nam is name. And of course, in Catholicism, there's I think in Worcester, Massachusetts, a Holy Names College or something, Holy Name. And so, what does it mean to be holy? To be holy is to have the quality of the divine. And so the name is holy. I mean, in Hebrew, Baruch Shem Kavod Malchutam Le'olam Ve'olam, blessed is the holy name of God forever and ever. So throughout world religions, Buddhism, Judaism, Christianity, certainly, and in Sanskrit you have Abheda Tvam Nama Nami No, that God is not different from his name. that the name of God and God, because God is fully present in his name. Cratylus, that's the Platonic dialogue, the Cratylus, where Socrates is wondering whether certain words are identical to the names for, that is, or to the objects they name. And so the idea here is that when you chant names of God, in any language, you know, your choice, it can be any language, it can be any religious or spiritual tradition. If you think of a child, when a child calls for the mother, father, it doesn't matter. I mean, the mother's not going to say, sorry, you didn't pronounce my name right. It's, you know, when your child calls you, if you're a parent, if you're a loving parent, and your child calls, and your child really needs you, you go there. And so you could just cry out to God just in any language, just even a non, just help. You know, in a sense, it's like a name of God. So the idea is that it's said in this age, which is considered a very fallen age, if you look at the previous yoga practices, they're extremely demanding, that by chanting the names of God, you are immediately in a state of yoga, because you are immediately connected to God. And so we do these other things, but by chanting or singing or remembering or saying or just any contact with the names of God, you're actually in direct contact with God, and your existence becomes divinized. You know, it's like the example is given, if you put iron, an iron rod, into fire, the iron becomes fire. It becomes fiery. And so the secret of yoga, the secret of the fast track, so to speak, to enlightenment is that if you put your existence directly in touch with God's existence, if you put your consciousness directly in touch with God's consciousness, your consciousness regains its original divine nature. And the example is given of a spark that falls out of a fire. It goes out. You put the spark back in the fire, it ignites. And so because we are tiny souls, it is only in that fire of the Supreme Consciousness that our divine consciousness comes to life. And, or it's like a leaf. A leaf on a tree lives only as long as it's connected to the tree. You pull the leaf off the tree, it loses life. You know, turns brown, crumbles, it's gone. It's history. The leaf can only live through its yoga to the tree. The spark can only be fire through its yoga with the fire. And so it's the very nature of our existence that we can experience and enjoy and live our real life, our real self, only by maintaining that yoga, that connection with the Supreme Consciousness. And so all these means, by offering food, by singing songs, by discussing, by let's say, offering your work, if you're an artist, if you're a builder, if you're, I mean, whatever, it just whatever we do, trying to do that as karma yoga, as a spiritual offering, we spiritualize our entire existence, and we come to our original pure consciousness, and then when we leave this body, we're fully liberated. In fact, even in this life, it's called Jivan Mukta. Even while you're living in this body, you can actually be liberated and experience your eternal nature. So that's the Bhakti Yoga thing. Anyway, thank you very much for your attention. And perhaps if you have any questions or...
Many. There are many.
yeah, please.
I'm dying. Well, the first thought is, if you start naming the divine, aren't you in some sense limiting the divine?
Good question.
It's only a description. It can only be a partial description of the divine.
Very good. To be very clear, yes and no. I mean, what you say is certainly true. However, if we consider that God is present in his name, and first of all, there are innumerable, infinite names of God. So you could say this particular name is limited or limiting. But if God is present in his name, then a name, even though it may seem phonetically limited, like let's say if you say Krishna, that's a K sound and not an S sound, or at the beginning, or not a T sound. So it's a specific phoneme. At the same time, if God is present in his name, and if by chanting or singing or remembering or whatever, hearing, that name, I experience God as an infinite being, then the name is not limiting me, it's actually removing barriers. There was, and of course there are infinite names of God. And to give an example, there was an ancient Greek for a mystic community called the Orphics. And they had an interesting idea that form removes limits. Because we're used to the other version, that form is limiting. And so here are some examples of how form actually removes limits. Let's say we just have a sound, like you could just make a guttural sound, like just any sound, just a sound. And so then you ask, what's the semantic content? Like, how much meaning is really being conveyed there? Something, perhaps, but not a tremendous amount. But let's say you take sound, human sound, and you begin to shape and structure it through the structure of language. So that, you know, we string together sounds to make words, and through syntax we make phrases and sentences and so on. And so really you could say there's no limit to what can be expressed through language. In that sense, you could see language, which is a structuring of sound, you could see language as something which is removing barriers and limits and opening up infinite possibilities. You could say, in terms of sound, you could say the same for music. You could say the same for music. I mean, in the hands of a great composer, it's astonishing what can be expressed. And visual arts, if you just took just a lump of clay, so that's nice, but in the hands of a great sculptor, the meaning starts to expand. So I think the idea that form is limiting, whether it's phonetic form or say like a spatial form, whatever, I think it's a more complex issue than that. It's not merely limiting. Yes?
Could it be that each name of God or image of God meets a certain need? For instance, in the Hebrew scriptures, there were many names for God, such as Jehovah Jireh, the God who provides. There was a need in that moment. So that name, that image of God, was meaningful. It met that need. It didn't necessarily confine God to that. But in that moment, that need was met.
That is very true. To give an analogy, I will always be grateful. As I get older, I become more and more grateful for the fact that I had very good parents. You know, Mark Twain said when I was, 18 or 20, I left home. My parents didn't understand anything. I went back a few years later, and I was amazed at how much they learned in my absence. So, finish that.
Yeah,
so,
I was just going to kind of answer that, because to me, a name, we as humans with our mental thought, sometimes we need something to identify with, and I think it's the individual that will limit the God with the name or not. Because, like I said, with being human nature, we're curious. We have to have something within our mind to identify.
Okay, well, let's take that thought and then apply it to what you said. If someone thinks, okay, I was hungry, God fed me, thanks. Now I don't think about God anymore because since then I've got a good job. And so then it's just sort of like using it. But let's say, like, remembering how good your parents were to you and how hard they worked to provide for you. And so when I remember that, it just fills me with gratitude. So the fact that there is a God who cares about our needs is remembering a need, but with gratitude and with appreciation. And ultimately, it's like Krishna says in the Gita, that I come to this world when dharma, or virtue, or justice is declining, I come to this world and reestablish dharma. And so the fact that there's this example, as Jesus taught about, he was so concerned about people treating each other properly. And I think one of the most brilliant contributions of Jesus was taking this huge apparatus of technical and ritual law, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, and boiling it down to two Old Testament statements, that you should love God with all your heart, soul, and might, and love your neighbor as yourself. And I think that was a brilliant bit of exegesis. And obviously Jesus was deeply concerned about people behaving properly toward each other. The Good Samaritan, you know, the good people who fed me when I was hungry and comforted me when I was lonely, because whatever you did to the lowest of my people, you did to me. And so, so we would expect God to be not simply all-powerful, like he can beat up any other creature in the universe, or God is omniscient, but that God is a supreme moral agent. God is really the source of and the infinite reservoir of goodness and virtue. And so calling God the provider or the sustainer is, let's say, it's not just like an animal recognition. You fed me, like a dog licks your hand when you feed it or something. But rather, it's an appreciation. You're profoundly moved that someone so great would be so kind. There's a lot of very rich, very powerful people in this world who aren't extremely concerned about us. Oh, they say they are when they're trying to get our votes. So, but the fact that someone could be infinitely great and yet infinitely intimate and concerned is... So yes, I mean, in a sense, what you said is true. I mean, what both of you said, all of you said is true, that we have different names for God because of his or her or their different activities and glories or attributes or virtues and so on. And, I mean, so it's true that you could say there's a limit, but at the same time, it's a gateway to infinity.
I have a... because I have to leave for a minute. The stumbling block for me is the same with Christ as with Krishna. Why do we have that sense that we have to incarnate the divine? Why do we have to put him into a body?
Okay.
I don't...
What was the question?
Why do we have to incarnate the divine? Put God into Krishna, or Krishna is God, Christ is God. I don't see a need for that.
Okay. First of all, I would say if we were really doing that, there would definitely be like theological penalty flags. I mean, because if I was actually doing that, then of course I can't put God in, you know, in this or that form. It comes to one of the great, you could say, issues. I always call it the great theological divide. That if you study the history of religions, you find in every religion, actually, without exception, every world religion, there was a great debate over whether God is a person or impersonal, whether God has form or doesn't have form, and so on. And you find this in all the world religions, actually, this great debate, this great divide. So, the first thing I would do, of course, you know, this is a dirty trick, argument, first thing you do is get grammatical. So the first thing I would do is, as soon as you say, why do we have to, there is a tension between freedom and necessity. In other words, I'm free to do what I want, I have to do that. So it's this freedom versus necessity. And so as soon as we use that particular auxiliary verb, like we have to do something, then it implies or entails that there's a necessity, like Krishna has to be God, or Jesus, or God has to, or the Son God, or the Son of God has to be Jesus. And I think that when we frame it in terms of necessity, it's almost like, let's say, if it rains right now, which is unlikely, but let's say if it rains and there's no ground covering, the ground must get wet. If I take an object and let go of it and there are no intervening conditions that would, let's say, interfere with the normal working of the laws of physics, and I just drop an object, it will fall, it must fall. So it's the nature of physical entity. Do you want to ask something? Okay, let me just finish this, and then you'll be next. It's the nature of physical relationships like physics or chemistry, whatever, is that you study necessary relationships. The whole materials, the whole world of, let's say, I say material science in the philosophical sense, not science of like different materials, but it's the whole nature of material science that it studies necessary relationships. And that's why psychology and sociology have never been reduced to a hard science. Why? Because there's this wild card, there's this spoiler, which is human free will. And that's why psychology will never be physics. And that's why actually all these wannabe real scientists and psychologists get into neurology and drugs and everything because they're trying to be real scientists. But the idea is that so if God is the infinitely free, infinitely autonomous being, then God's acts, God's decisions, including the decision to appear in a certain way, are acts which are entirely free. And so if we say, why does God have to be Krishna? He doesn't. Why does God, or the Son of God, have to be Jesus? He doesn't. So it's not about necessity, it's about freedom. It's about divine beings freely choosing to act in certain ways. And if you think about it, the people we love, or the people we really admire, I mean, we love lots of people, but some people we really admire and love, which is not just like, I love and feel sorry for you. But the people... the people we really love and admire, we admire and love them for their free choices, because they've got style, they've got grace, they have virtue. They just, it's the things they choose freely to do that we, wow, that was such a class act. Rather than the things they're forced to do. And so ultimately, in a sense, we love God for his own freely chosen acts. Not for the things that, like, why does God have to be this or that? So yeah, there is no necessary causal chain that, given the way the world is, given the laws of atmospheric science and physics and this and that, and astronomy, that God would have to be blue like Krishna. So there is no such necessary causal chain, or the Son of God had to be Jesus. These are free acts by divine beings. And we come to love them in the way we love other people. We just love the way they are. We love their use of their free will.
So thank you.
Yes.
Yes.
Well, I just wanted to continue on with Jorge's line of thinking of why we impose physical attributes onto a metaphysical entity, God, Krishna, however, in that. Is it just a mental stepping stone that us as a physical creature have to go through to understand a more abstract concept? Because Taoism, it basically indicts itself in its own doctrine, saying that in the spoken language, the intent behind it is lost.
Okay.
Tibetan Buddhism, the doctrine, the founding doctrine and book based on Siddhartha Gautama.
Yes, Siddhartha Gautama.
Yeah, that it's the, you need to do all these steps to... to achieve enlightenment, because it's, you have to start at the bottom and learn all the different phases to gain the awareness to move on to the next phase.
Yeah, this gets into, very interesting, this gets into things like philosophy of language. And history shows that the people who taught that language ultimately can't describe the truth tended to write more books than anybody else. But I have, but these personal theistic traditions have a very different view of language. Language is not some inferior thing. You see, because again, the great divide is personalism and impersonalism. So if ultimately you, as a unique, wonderful person, are real, okay, you're in a body, okay, you're not completely pure, you're not completely enlightened, but that can be fixed. You know, you can purify yourself, you can find enlightenment. But the basic fact that you are an individually unique person is not something to be done away with by meditation. The way I put it is, suicide is not healthy, whether it's physical or philosophical. It's not healthy. And so, if the personal, I'm not like a crude, you know, anthropomorphic, whatever, but, and I'm talking about personal here, not as merely being biologically, physically human, but being personal, consciousness. If that's real, and I would say it is real, that it is not a step upward to depersonalize yourself. That's not progress, that's regress. And so because you as a person are real, language is real. Sure, ordinary physical language, let's say like, you know, the talking heads on TV or all that stuff, or things maybe a little more refined like cartoons. It's, you know, all the ordinary mundane uses of language, that's one thing. But it's sort of in a Neoplatonic sense, or even a Platonic sense. That's not the original language. There is original, pure spiritual language, which gets reflected imperfectly on the physical plane. So if we say that, let's say a form of God, like the Bible says we're made in the image of God, or the in the Vaishnava or the Vedic side, they talk about spiritual forms. We can't beg the question. We can't reason in a circular fashion by assuming that when great avatars come down, that they have physical bodies. In other words, if there is spiritual form, if there is spiritual color, if there is spiritual music, if there is spiritual love, spiritual relationships, if all the beautiful things of this world are real, but they're reflections of a greater world, then it's not about dumping everything in your philosophical dumpster. For example, let's say you stand on the bank of a clear pond, and the water is still, and you see an apple tree reflected in the water. Now, you can't eat the reflected apples. It's just a reflection. But even though it's not a real apple tree, it tells you a lot about a real apple tree. So this world, according to this view, and this is something which you find in Greek philosophers, is something which you find in Vedanta, I mean, it's found in a lot of places throughout history, that this world is a reflection of a greater world. And this body, this physical body, is a mere reflection of an eternal body with fantastic powers and beauties. And so the reason we're frustrated in this world is because we're trying to eat the reflections of apples. We're hungry, but we're trying to eat the reflection. So if you turn your eyes upward to the real tree, there is a real tree. Otherwise, if in any way, shape, or form, God created the world, and even Buddhists talk about creation acts and things like that, why would an impersonal God create a personal world? And what's the point? Why would I give up a world with all, you know, this wacky world we live in? Why would I give this up to go to a world where there are no colors, there's no melody, there's no harmony, you don't fall in love with anybody, you never dance, there's no beautiful nature? Why would I give this up just to go by meditation into a world which is stripped of everything that's beautiful and call that enlightenment? You know, and regarding Buddhism, by the way, here's a little historical.
Taking Mary with me.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mil gracias, Jorge. Hasta la próxima. Muchísimo gusto. If you look at Buddhism, and we do a little historical fact checker here. Buddha never said, by the way, that there's no soul. When I used to teach this at universities, the second sermon of the Buddha, which is like, you know, it's like sermon number two after the grand opening of Buddhism. you know, we're still in that gala event of the opening of Buddhism. Sermon number two, which was officially called the Sermon on the Non-Existence of the Self. Only problem, Buddha doesn't say there's no self. It's only two paragraphs, this sermon. I mean, you can see that Buddha was extremely merciful. He gave very short sermons. So in the Sermon on the Non... He never said that. Buddha didn't do Siddhartha Gautama, the original Buddha. Didn't do metaphysics. It even frustrated some of his followers' life. How come you don't do metaphysics? And he even gave the example that, you know, if you're shot with an arrow, pull the arrow out. Don't worry about other things for now. And so the actual historical Buddha did not deny the self, did not deny God, didn't deny any of these things. He said, I'm not going to talk about it. Rather, get this. You're suffering, number one. Number two, you're suffering because you're selfish, basically. If you stop being selfish, you'll stop suffering. And the way to stop being selfish is to have, you know, live right by Dharma. Right thinking, right speech, right everything. Mm-hmm. That's it. That was the program. In fact, if you look at Christian history, the first great councils, like, I mean, Nicaea was not one of the first ones, but if you look at the great councils in very early Christianity, they were all, you know, going to the mat. They got into this octagon, and they were going at it over doctrine, theology, the status of Jesus, the status, and so on and so forth. In contrast, if you look at the earliest Buddhist councils, because inevitably the great charismatic leader departs this world, you got to figure things out, keep the movement going, what do we really believe? But all the first Buddhist councils were not about doctrine. They're about practice. Like, should a monk eat once a day or twice a day? Or should you meditate in the morning or the afternoon or both? It was not a movement about doctrine. The historical Buddha didn't want to get into that. So later, what you find, this is what actually happened, this is the history. Later you get this Mahayana Buddhism, which is, you know, there's nothing wrong with it. It has a lot of really great things about it. But Mahayana Buddhism, which is now 85% of the living Buddhists in the world, looked at the early days of Buddhism, the historical Siddhartha Gautama and all that, and they were embarrassed. Because they found it was so Spartan. It was so, like, Buddha said very little. He just said, like, you're suffering, you know, you're selfish and all that. And so what they did is, they ridiculed it. Not Buddha. But who's that, what is that, Anyway, it's one of the direct disciples of Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama. And he was like the thinker in the community. I mean, in Buddhism, it's a little community, a few followers of the Buddha. And I think, what is it, Sariputra or something like that? But anyway, he was like the thinker, he was the philosopher among the group. He became the butt of jokes in Mahayana Buddhism. He became like a clown figure. And Mahayana Buddhism, they even came up with this doctrine of, God, am I rusty. Anyway, it was the idea that Buddha, same thing he said about Jesus, to try to, you know, cover for some of the lacunas there, that, well, he had more to teach, but he couldn't tell these people. And so then they attributed to Buddha all kinds of doctrines, basically in the open marketplace of ideas, in like in a level playing field, because there was kind of religious freedom in Asia. Buddhism, in order to compete and really become a world religion, it had to provide all kinds of basic religious services. I mean, imagine, for example, you're living, let's say, in the early centuries, like the first several centuries of Buddhism, it's in India. And so let's say you're living in a village, because everyone lived in little villages, and let's say someone you love very much passed away. It could be a parent, it could be a child, it could be a spouse, you know, someone that you're really attached to has passed away. And let's say we're about, 2,300 years ago in India. So Buddhism is a major contender, also Jainism, and of course, the original thing is the Vedic religion, so, but it's a real, you know, it's a really lively period, everyone competing for the hearts and minds of the people there. And someone you love very much passed away. And the Buddhist person in your area says, well, don't worry, because your mother, I mean, it's not even your mother, it's like, there is no one there, it's just like, it's an illusion. It's just a bunch of streaming electrons and molecules and atoms and everything. And meanwhile, someone else comes along, let's say it could be perhaps the Hindu preacher, and says, well, your mother was a really good person, and she was dear to God, and she's with God, and you will be with her. I mean, guess who wins? I mean, talking about, you know, the campaigns that were going on. So what happened, if you look at the history of Buddhism, this is, very briefly, the history of Buddhism, let's just take India, we can talk about other countries, but it started as, you know, like there was this whole 7-Up campaign that's like the Un-Coke or something, Un-Cola.
The Un-Cola.
Yeah, so Buddhism started as the Un-Vedanta or the Un-Veda or something. And so it was very Spartan, like no philosophy, no metaphysics, you're suffering because you're, et cetera, et cetera. But as it grew, they had to, or they felt they had to really compete for the hearts and minds of the people. So what happened is, having rejected this whole cosmology, religious cosmology, it all seeped back in. So you go, so as scholars have noted, approximately, let's say, 1,000 years after the historical Buddha, about 500 AD, Buddhism in India had become practically indistinguishable from Hinduism. And you look at Mahayana Buddhism, I mean, the bodhisattvas, the saviors, they have paradise, they have heaven, you know, salvation, and everything. They've got it all. It became a full-service religion. One-stop shopping. All your religious needs. And sort of like the Buddhism that's often presented in the West to generally, let's say, like educated liberal people, you know, one hand clapping or this or that, that's sort of like a very carefully packaged, you know, it's shrink-wrapped and all that thing. That's not the Buddhism that became a great world religion. I'm not saying therefore it's wrong, I'm not saying it's bad, I'm just saying it's not the Buddhism that became a world religion. The Buddhism that became a world religion was the Buddhism that told, you know, your daddy went to heaven and everything else. And worshiping, having little, you know, icons in Japan and China, they have altars, it's just, it's, again, practically it became indistinguishable from Hinduism. So, because it just didn't, at a basic human level, it didn't work for people just to say there's no self. In fact, there was a Buddhist group called the Pudgalavadis, who were very prominent in the first centuries of Buddhism, the first several centuries of Buddhism, they were very prominent. And then they gradually waned and no one even knows they existed, but they were very prominent. And they said, look everybody, there's obviously something like a soul. Because otherwise, Buddhists were obsessed with karma, like good karma, I want to get good karma, I don't want bad karma. Buddhist monks, they were like very concerned about this. But if you're not a person, who gets the karma? How could you be, and this is what the Pudgalavadis, these were Buddhists in good standing, how can you be morally responsible for your acts if there's no you? Why can't you just shoot an innocent person? Because you don't exist in that person. You can't say, I shot him because I don't exist and he doesn't exist. And how could I get karma if I don't exist?
That was a question I always had, because I had 10 years of Zen training, as many of you guys know. So my teacher didn't believe in reincarnation. He said, I asked him questions about reincarnation. He says, forget about it. You're here now, enjoy now, and forget the... You know, that was his... Of course, he was very iconoclastic himself. Pretty interesting guy, Philip Whalen. He was a beat poet, too. He knew people like Allen Ginsberg and all those guys. But one of the questions I always had was, okay, if there is no self, there is no permanent self, so to speak, or no soul, then what the hell is it that reincarnates? Because yeah. I do teach reincarnation.
Oh, very much.
There was this very strange, and then it could never answer
and
that.
How can you be, and how can you be morally responsible if right. you don't exist?
Right.
So, yeah. And again, Buddha never said there's no soul. What Buddha does in the second sermon, you can Google it, you can read it when you go home, it's only two paragraphs, it's merciful. So, he goes through this, the Upanishads, like the ancient theology, he goes through this list, he says, all the different layers of your being, like, take your external body, your physical body, is that the eternal soul? Obviously not. Okay, what about your mundane mind? Is that the eternal soul? No. What about your mundane reason? Is that the eternal soul? No. He goes in his checklist, no, 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 end of the sermon. And you find the same list in the Upanishads. He wasn't saying something that no one ever said before. He was just saying, this is not your eternal self. He never said there's no eternal self. And later Buddhists, you see, because some Buddhists became very adamant that there's no self. And there was actually a problem, like, why didn't Buddha ever say it? And they had discussions on this, like, why didn't Buddha say there's no self? Like, we know there's no self, but why didn't he say it? Because he didn't say it. Yes?
You're talking about the psychology of someone who will speak, and the psychology of sounds good, that's why they believe it, because it sounds, just sounds great. So, to me, Krishna consciousness, it sounds better than anything I've ever heard. So how do you know that that is objectively true?
Well, what Buddha said is true. I mean, in my view, I mean, we are suffering. We are suffering because we're selfish. And if we stop being selfish, we will be much happier, and we can be get over selfishness by a serious spiritual practice. So I'm not saying what Buddha said is wrong. In fact, I think what he said is right. And of course, something you could say, well, it has a ring of truth, therefore it's true. I mean, obviously we have to come to a higher consciousness. And Krishna says in the Gita, pratyakshavagamam, that when you practice real yoga or bhakti yoga, you experience things directly. There's direct, you understand things by direct experience.
How does those experiences manifest?
Well, Brother Lawrence, mm-hmm. practicing the presence of God, that you, well, there, okay, here's a verse that explains it from the Bhagavatam, that's a larger word. Is it, bhakti pareshanu bhuho vidrakti ranyatracha, that the example is given that, I won't give you all the Sanskrit, but just as you're eating, as when a person is eating, they experience simultaneously tushti, pushti, kshudapaya, satisfaction. As you're eating, you feel satisfied. You feel nutrition, strength. You feel you're being nourished. And kshudapaya, literally hunger going away. And that's something you directly experience when eating. As my teacher used to say, no one has to tell you that you're becoming satisfied as you're eating. You experience it. So in the same way, if you are truly approaching God, if you are truly surrendering to God, then you will experience three things simultaneously, which are bhakti, you will feel devotion welling up in you, just natural love. It's like when you fall in love with someone, you just feel this more and more appreciation, and you feel great pleasure in praising someone who is most deserving of praise. And so bhakti pareshanu bhava, you experience the presence of God everywhere. You experience that, you know, you're in the presence of God. You can feel it, that I'm in the presence of God. And viraktir, you detachment. Things that, let's say, you were attached to, and you knew, like, this is not an intelligent attachment. It can be a relationship, like, why am I attached to someone that really is not reciprocating with me, that doesn't deserve all the attention I'm giving them? It's like, you know, why am I acting like this? Why can't I be reasonable? And why can't my heart listen to what my brain is saying? Because after all, God has given us a heart and a brain. We have both, and they're both really useful. And so as you advance spiritually, you start to become free of attachments which you cannot intelligently justify. Like, I'm attached to this thing, or I'm having this emotion, but my best intelligence thinks I'm being a dummy. And so you gradually become attached to those things, and you have the power to see clearly what's right, what's wrong, what's good for me, what's not, and you can act on it. You can act on your best understanding. And so these things come. Oh, time. Well, you've been, as Elvis used to say.
It's a man-made subject.
What's that?
Spiritual realm, there is no time.
Right. Yeah, thank you so much. Swamiji's going to be here for at least a week, right?
Till Saturday morning.
Till Saturday morning, so he'll be at Govinda's tonight.
You got to run. Okay.
But thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.